First, I want to thank the organizing committee for organizing this workshop. I'm very happy to come here and present some of my ongoing research on problem of model selection and network construction for high throughput biological data. First of all, I want to mention that model selection or variable selection problem actually is a very widely existing problem in many areas of statistics. For example, if you look at the financial applications, nowadays we have the financial crisis of the mortgage crisis. Nowadays the banking institutions are actually taking stringent controls. They want to measure the risks of lending money to the borrowers. So they collect hundreds of information of the borrowers, and then they want to narrow down to probably 20 variables that can reflect the risk of this mortgage. So this actually, if you look at it, is a very simple variable selection problem. Among like hundreds of thousand predictors, we want to find the most significant predictor. If we look at image analysis, so if we want to compress an image, we can use wavelet transformation. Now, wavelet represent image using the coefficient. But if you want to maintain certain resolution, then you want to set many of the coefficients to the zero. So you want to thresholding it. But how do I select this thresholding rule so that I can select the most significant features of this image? So that is also a model selection or variable selection problem. Now in biology, in the last part of my talk, I will talk about the application of model selection in chemogenomics. So that problem is in pharmaceutical industry, they have many potential drugs or potential chemicals. So they measure the chemical activities in the cell lines. And on the other hand, they have high throughput biological data. They have gene expression data. On the gene expression data, they have over 20,000 genes measured. So what they want to do is, given a drug, I want to know the targets. So among the 20,000 predictors, I want to narrow down, I want to find the targets of the drug. But this is just like looking for needles in an ocean. I have 20,000 genes. How do I narrow down my search to find most significant predictors? So that is also a model selection problem. But now let's look at this problem in a very naive way. Now if you have a model and many parameters, I can estimate it using very traditional likelihood method or any other method. Now I want to make it a parsimonious model. So this is a really a compromise. You want a good fitting model, so you want to throw in as many parameters as possible. On the other hand, we want a very simple model to reflect in the underlying physical mechanisms. So it's a compromise or trade-off between the model fitting and the complexity of the model. So the naive way or any people can think of is I can give some penalty. I penalize the model with more parameters. So throughout my talk today, I will talk about how to select the penalties. So the penalty has to be a very wise choice so that it can guarantee us that once we use this criteria, we can select the best model. Guarantees the consistency. So when we have large sample, it's guaranteed that we will select the correct model, unknown correct model with probability 10 into 1. So the key question we have to keep in mind is how to design the penalty to penalize and to make the balance between a model fitting and the complexity of model. We don't want overcomplicated model which really doesn't reveal the underlying physical mechanism. Okay, so there are three parts of my talk. The first part resides in the traditional paradigm. So that is when we have fixed number of predictors. And then we have the number of sample size goes to infinity. So we can talk about asymptotic behavior of model selection criteria. Okay. The second part of the talk is really update. So nowadays people have a large dimensional problem. So the number of predictors can go large as well. So P denotes the number of covariates or the number of parameters. So now we consider the situation that the number of parameters P also tends to infinity in the same order as the number of sample size. So P can in the same order of n to the certain power of k. K can be any constant. So then in that case, most of the traditional methods will fail because we we just didn't think in that way. We just didn't have that kind of data before. Like the parameters can go to infinity as well as the sample size. So that's the second part of the talk. We'll talk about how we can address that issue. Third, we will talk about how we use the model selection criteria we have developed and then apply it in chemo genomics data. So I think everybody knows about microarray. So that is the type of data I'm going to focus on today. And then I'll link that to drug activity data. So gene expression data, gene expression technology has gained wide popularity in the scientific community in the last 10 years. So this technology, so the scientists first prepare the tissues or cell lines, and then they extract mRNA from the cell lines or tissues, and then they use the RT-PCR to amplify that RNA, and then they label the RNA with certain dyes, fluorescent dyes, and then they immerse that chip there into this mRNA solution, and then there is a hybridization occurred between the RNA and the DNA. So once we have the chip, scientists use laser scanner to scan the chip and obtain the image. So here is the image. So as you can see, this is the image contains of millions of pixels. Each pixel can tell you hybridization intensity of a certain gene in the genome. So on this typical array, we can have over 20,000 genes. Each gene has a tiny spot corresponding to it, and the color or the hybridization intensity just tells you how much that gene is expressed. So we have over 20,000 measurements given in one single shot like this. Okay, this here, this diagram just give us the chemical mechanisms between the hybridization between the RNA and the DNA. So it's just if the RNA can find the perfect match, can find the DNA probe in the chip, that DNA probe is designed to reflect a specific sequence in the genome. So if it hybridizes, then we will observe a hybridization intensity for that probe. And this is a typical image of a microarray image. As you can see, they have millions of pixels on it, so have over thousands, 20,000 of genes measured. Okay. And then in chemical genomics area, so the pharmaceutical company wants to have a better way to screening drugs. So they have the drugs, they measure drugs in the cell lines, many, many cell lines of tissues. So they have the drug activity measurements. So that is the response. And on the other hand, we have the gene expression data, so we have 20,000 predictors. So what they want to do is to link these two types of data. Oh, sorry. So I have the drug activities throughout, for example, 60 cell lines. And for each cell line, I have 20,000 genes measured for that specific cell line. So what specific subset of genes actually can predict the activities of this drug? So what they want to do is to find the targets of the drug. So here we think about the architecture of the drug and its associated gene. So this is a very simple graph, but the potential candidates actually are 20,000. I cannot show it in this diagram, but the chemist wants to know, given these two types of data and the drug, what are the set of genes that directly interacting with the drug. So that if what we think the first layer of the network is the drug, and the second layer of the network consists of the genes directly interacting with the drug, the chemist really wants to pin down which set of genes are directly interacting with the drug so that they can manipulate the drug, giving more ligands or just to manipulate the drug so that it can get the best effect they want. Now, throughout the 20,000 genes, over 20,000 genes, there are other genes probably are also associated with the drug, but they are through indirect interaction. For example, if we look at this gene, it interacts with this guy, and those two three edges, it interacts with the drug, but it's indirect interacting, okay? But if you run the data, if you look at data, biologists tend to use the correlation analysis. So my collaborator ran a correlation analysis for certain drugs. They usually find over 5,000 genes correlated with certain drugs, and they were frustrated. Well, 5,000 genes are correlated. They couldn't be physically possible to interact with this drug. But how do I, like, to find out which are the second layer, the most important players in this picture? Okay. So the problem is how to select a target and understand the whole network. Okay. So given this motivating example, so we look at this problem in a more theoretical way. So basically, this is a model selection problem, a variable selection problem. So in statistical modeling, it's often the case that scientists put together a very large number of predictors. We do this to ensure that we don't miss out the important predictors. However, when you want to build a nice model to enhance the predictability, we really want a parsimonious model. So in traditional way, statistics do that variable selection through stepwise deletion or subset selection. So those are simple statistical methods we learn in elementary step course. But it's very hard to understand the statistical properties of this kind of stage-wise procedures, because when you do a selection procedure, the errors are inherited and propagated through the multiple ways. And then it will, because the predictors are so much, and in some sense that when you do them multiple times, then you really cannot control over errors. Okay. And then Bryman in 1996 also pointed out that the best subset selection also suffers the lack of stability. So the stability is when you have a data, if the data changes a little bit, then the model changes very dramatically. That is the lack of stability. We don't want that in practice. We really want, even if the data changes a little bit, our model can tolerate that, still yield the same set of predictors. Okay. So, so what we are advocating is to use a penalized way. So really doesn't matter which method you use. So the emphasis is the penalty. So suppose I'm a statistician, I want to use MLE, I use likelihood estimate. What I should do is to introduce some penalty into my estimation procedure. Okay. So suppose I use the likelihood, so I use penalized likelihood method. And then I can do the parameter estimation and variable selection and do these two things simultaneously, okay? But to have a very good penalty function, we have to, this penalty function really should possess the following properties. We want to keep that in mind when we design a good penalty, because the key issue is really to choose the penalty. The first thing is we want unbiasedness. That means when the true known parameter is large, it's truly significant, we don't want it to be estimated in a wrong way. So we want the resulting estimator should be asymptotically unbiased. Okay. The secondly is sparsity. We want the estimator should be a thresholding rule such that many, many small coefficients will be automatically set to zero. Okay. Just like when you have an image, you want to have a certain resolution, then any fine features will just automatically set to zero. And we also want continuity. That means even the data can fluctuate a little bit, the estimator should be continuous so that we can avoid instability in model selection. Okay. So let's give some insights on this requirement. Basically, just tell us what kind of penalty we want to choose. So actually, those three properties, actually, to satisfy these three properties is not a very difficult issue. So basically, the whole thing is, if I want to use a likelihood, my objective function is likelihood plus certain penalty. So now my objective function is the minus log function plus certain penalty. So the idea is very simple. Now, in order to satisfy the unbiasedness, what I need to do is, when the true parameter data, when it's really non-zero, I want the first derivative of my penalty when n goes to infinity, that is zero. That means it will go back to the true MLE. Okay. And the second property is we want it to be a thresholding rule. So the penalty term should be heavy enough to shrink the small coefficient towards zero. But for practitioners, this is a very hard question. How heavy is enough? How to choose the penalty? So this, to address this question, we should study the proper order of the tuning parameters. So we really have to have some mathematical results to guide the practitioners to choose the size of the tuning parameters. Okay. Let's consider a simple class of penalty functions. We call it LQ penalty functions. So they take this form. So it's lambda times beta to the power of Q. Now the solution is continuous. It's very easy to show that when Q is greater than or equal to 1. On the other hand, when Q is greater than 1, the penalty is not enough. So actually, it turns out nicely that the L1 penalty is the only member in this family which can satisfy the both requirements we just imposed, can produce both sparse solutions and continuous solutions. So that's why nowadays, in model selection, variable selection field, L1 penalty is very popular. It's simply because of this reason. So here I mainly just introduced three different kinds of penalty terms, penalty functions. The first one is very simple one, hard thresholding. And the second one is L1 penalty. Donahoe and Johnson proposed it in wavelet image analysis in 1994. Okay, so it's just simple L1 penalty. And then there's another penalty proposed by Fan Li in 2001. This is simply a spline function with two knots. So this algebraic expression doesn't provide much information, but I'm going to show you a picture. It's very easy to show this. Okay. So the first column of the pictures corresponds to the hard thresholding. Okay. So if you can see that this is very naive. So I choose the threshold. Everything below that threshold was set to zero. So this is data, this is estimate, was set to zero. Hard thresholding. Anything beyond that threshold, we take the initial, the previous estimate. So this is called hard thresholding. But the problem is, this is non-continuous. Okay? So it's very unstable in practice. And L1 penalty look like this. It's indeed continuous. But what's the problem? For large parameters, it actually is not unbiased. It pays the price of shifted by the lambda. So it's not, so you actually pay the price to be continuous, okay. Now the scat thresholding actually is a hybrid thing. So this penalty combines these two. As you can see, in the neighborhood of zero, it takes the shape of L1. When you go to large parameters, it just takes the shape of hard thresholding. It's just a hybrid thing. And then because of this hybrid thing, it inherits the advantage of this both. It's continuous here, but it's unbiased here for large parameters. So it's very nice. So suppose we use this penalty in practice. How do we choose the tuning parameters? That's a main problem we want to know. Okay. So we have just discussed advantages of this type of penalty function. It satisfies all the three conditions we imposed before. Okay. So suppose now I have a very practical problem I want to use, and I want to use the scat penalty functions. So this specific problem is to do the covariance selection in Gaussian graphic model. Okay. So what we have is we have peak covariance. So I have x1, x2, up to xp. Suppose they follow a multivariate normal. Okay. What I want to know is I want to build a graph to reflecting their relationship. Suppose x1 and x2 are interacting, they're dependent, and x1 and xp are interacting. Suppose this is the graph, okay. If you look at x1 and xp minus 1, there's no edge linking them, right? But if you look at the covariance matrix, they have very large correlation, simply because they have indirect interaction. Okay. So what we want to know is, having a Gaussian multivariate Gaussian data like this, we want to build, probably this is three, we want to build a graph tell us specifically what are the edges, what the edges are. Okay. So zero entry. So in order to study this, we want to estimate the inverse of the covariance matrix. Why do we want to estimate the the inverse of the covariance matrix? Because that concentration matrix is very interesting. It can indicate the conditional independence between the two random variables. Suppose we have x1 and xp minus 1. Given this, if we look at sigma 1 p minus 1, it will be probably non-zero. We cannot infer whether or not there is the edge linking them. But if we look at the entry in the inverse matrix, then it will be clearly zero. So the zero entries in the Cij or in the concentration matrix indicates the conditional independence between the two random variables. Okay, so that means if x1 and xp minus 1, all these are fixed because they don't have edges linking them, their conditional independence are zero. So this C1 p minus 1 will be zero. Okay, so that means if we can estimate the C matrix, we know the graph exactly. So in order to know the graphic model, the key parameters to estimate is this C matrix. Okay, and then this Gaussian random vector X can be represented by an undirected graph. G has two components. V contains P vertices corresponding to the P coordinates, and the edges E set represents the conditional dependency relationship between xi and xj. Okay, so that's a specific problem I have at hand. So I want to estimate this C, but I want this graphic to be sparse. I don't think everyone is connected, so I want to select the true edges. Okay, so it's of interest to identify the correct set of edges and estimate the parameters simultaneously. We can use MLE or L0 type penalty or stepwise forward selection, but they all have their own drawbacks. So what we do is use penalized likelihood estimation. So we just have a likelihood and use the step penalty function. And then we want to examine its asymptotic properties. How can we get the consistent result? Okay. So given that setup, so we can easily write out log likelihood because this is simply a multivariate Gaussian. So without any penalty, the estimates for the covariance matrix is the sample covariance matrix. Now I use the penalty. So I introduce my objective function. So this two term is the log likelihood. This is my scatter penalty term. Okay. Now we just set out to investigate whether or not this is a good approach or not. So we have shown that if we let the tuning parameter lambda goes to zero, then it's guaranteed that there exists a local root n consistent estimate of this C. Okay. So we want to estimate C0 is the true null value. Our penalized likelihood estimate is a root n consistent. So we can guarantee that. Okay. But what is the limiting distribution of this root and consistent estimator? Now I have the Cij. I have a set of non-zero ones, okay, which is C1. So C1 is the set of the Cij which are non-zero, corresponds to the true edges. I have C2 subset, which are Cij that are zeros. That means there's no edge in it. Okay. So under certain order. So the order is the lambda, tuning parameter lambda goes to zero. However, it has to be goes to zero in the correct speed. That is, the square root of n times lambda goes to infinity. Okay. So that means ensure that it still be heavy enough. So for example, to satisfy this, I can construct lambda equals log n over square root of n. If it's of that order, that satisfies this. This is just a working example we can choose, okay? So suppose the lambda has this order, then asymptotically speaking, with probability tending to 1, our root and consistent estimator leads to a sparse estimator. It's nice. It automatically sets you the speed 2 to 0, thresholded to 0 completely. So you will have many, many zero solutions. You don't need to worry about, you know, there's no edge. And for the C1 part, for the non-zero part, you see, it follows a very nice normal distribution. And it actually follows asymptotic normal distribution. The this asymptotic covariance matrix is the information matrix. So to summarize this, we observe that for the true zero parameters, they estimated at 0 with probability tending to 1. So we have a parsimonious model. For the non-zero components, they estimated as well as the correct model is known. And we call this as oracle property. So that means the method outperforms MLE. So that is a super efficiency. So why do people call this as oracle? Because in English, oracle means God knows. But here, we don't know the true model. Only God knows. When we use this penalty method using correct order of penalty, it turns out that our estimate is the same as MLE under the correct submodel. You see, as the correct submodel, although we don't know it. So we get that just as God knows it. Okay, so that's called oracle property. It's a very nice property for this type of procedure. Okay. So we can show using this, we have the oracle properties. Okay. So as we see that the performance of the proposed penalized likelihood method relies on the proper choice of the tuning parameter. But still, in practice, we don't have any guidelines yet to how to choose the lambdas. So we need to have a data-driven method to make the selection of the tuning parameter automatically. Okay. So in practice, how do we do? How do we select the lambda? Okay. Here is just some notation. Okay. So we have seen that E denotes the edge set. So we can have EF, which is the full model, everyone is connected. We can have ET, which is the true model. Okay. And we can have overfitting model, that means we have some edges which do not exist. We can have an underfitting model, that means we have some edge missing. Okay. So suppose we look at the parameter space of lambda. Lambda is our tuning parameter. We can decompose it into three space. The first space is omega 0. That means if we choose lambda from that space, the estimated E is the same as the true graphic structure. We can have omega plus. That means that is the space. When we choose lambda from it, we will get overfitted model. Omega minus means the underfitted model. So if we choose lambda from that set, we'll get estimated edge set, which is the underfitted model. Okay. Okay. So what is the data-driven method we use? So here we propose to use a BIC information criteria. So BIC is widely used in traditional model selection. But in this case, we give it a penalty flavor in it. So it's called a BIC. This criteria takes this specific form, okay? So the first part is the log likelihood with the penalized likelihood estimate stuck into it, okay? And the last part is the penalty term. We have log n times this summation is actually the total number of edges we obtain. It's the complexity of this graph, okay? So we penalize on that. We want to have a sparse network, so we penalize on the number of edges we find. So this is a BIC. It just looks exactly like a BIC with the penalized likelihood estimates put in it, okay? Now, suppose on the other hand, suppose we know the correct model, we can have the BIC criteria with the maximum likelihood estimates under the correct model. We call it BIC-GT. So let's look at this too, compare them, okay? Suppose we construct a working sequence of this lambda, okay, we can show that if we use that lambda, the BIC criteria approach to the BIC of correct model with probability tending to 1, okay? So that's nice. if we look at other space, so lambda from the underfitted space or overfitted space, we can show that with probability tending to 1, their BIC criteria will be consistently larger than our working sequence. So all this implies that the lambdas that fail to identify the true model will always give us BIC lower than the lambda n, our working sequence. So this, consequently, if we select the lambda value which minimizes the BIC criteria, we identify the true model. So this basically establishes the consistency of BIC criteria under this penalized likelihood framework. So basically, we just use a series of lambda, and then we use the lambda that minimize the BIC. We know that, asymptotic speaking, anything that minimizes BIC will be the correct model. So we use this criteria to select the correct model. Okay. So that is the approach in this penalized framework. Okay. And then we establish the consistency of this and also gives the practical guideline how to select this. So all you need to do is you punch in a series of lambdas, and for each lambda you calculate BIC for that lambda. And that which lambda minimizes BIC, that is the tuning parameter I have to choose. And as in public speaking, I know that will give me the correct model. Okay. So that is the story for this. Okay. So as you can see, we can use this to build gene networks. We have gene expression data. We just think of them as multivariate normal. Then we can use this method very conveniently to build up the gene networks. Okay. We have compared our method with other methods, and empirically speaking, we have better performance. Okay, the empirical measure is the KL loss functions, but I will omit this. Just want to show you, empirically speaking, this method has very good performance. And then I want to jump to another more relevant problem, which puzzles probably everybody in the model selection field is, how do you model selection when we have high dimensional space? Okay. So the previous discussion is focused on the problem that we have fixed number of parameters. But suppose the parameters also explode as n tends to infinity. So with the advent of high throughput biological data, scientists often encounter the problem of model selection that p has the same order as n. Okay. So the traditional approach, like the one I've just mentioned, totally becomes inadequate at all. And consistency of all the traditional model selection criteria doesn't hold anymore. So we need new ideas and new techniques. Okay. So let's first examine what is the BIC information criteria and then how to modify it to address the high dimensional problem. Okay. So here is just a little bit of review on BIC criteria. So given a likelihood, L of theta, so that's the likelihood when we have ID observations. Suppose we have 1 up to P possible covariates. Now I want to select a submodel. So I use the little s to denote the submodel, which is subset of 1 up to P. Okay. Under this submodel, I denote by data s the parameters, with those components outside s being set to 0. So they are set to 0. Only those parameters within s are the parameters included in the model. So in 1978, Schwarz proposed the Bayesian information criteria to select a model. This BIC criteria takes this form. The first form is minus 2 log likelihood. The second form is log n, which is the order we put there. And then VS is basically the number of components of the model complexity for the model. Okay. So why do people use BIC? Okay. So this actually is from a Bayesian point of view. So what Schwarz thought in his mind is, suppose we have this many models, let big S denote the model space. There are so many possible S. If I give them some prior, for example, equal prior, I think all the model has the same prior probabilities. And then, given the data, I can look at the posterior probability of that model. So we can write out the posterior probability in this way using the Bayes formula. So very simple, you don't need to look into the details. And then Schwarz think this is a fair game. For each model, I assign prior equal prior probability. And then based on the data, I will select a model which has the, maximize the posterior probability, okay? And then, under this assumption, it's very easy to write out Laplace transformation of this posterior probability. And then it can be shown that this to maximize this posterior probability is equivalent to minimize this BIC criteria. Okay, the last term just appears because of the Laplace transformation. Okay, so this is a BIC is also consistent in many traditional settings. So that's why it's very widely used. Okay. Now, what is the problem of equal prior when we have large model space? Okay. Here we give a very simple example. Now, suppose we follow the thinking of Schwartz. Now we have P equals 1,000 predictors. If we look at a model with one covariate, how many models there are? There are 1,000 such models. If we look at the models with two predictors, how many models there are? There are 1,000 times 999 over 2. Under the equal prior assumption, then the probability assigned to two varied models actually is much larger than the probability assigned to one covariate model, which is 999 over 2 times greater than that assigned to the covariate model. That means if I use BIC, it will very naturally the BIC will favor the covariate model because of this equal prior assumption. Okay. So this actually is against the principle of parsimony. Okay. So in order to correct this equal prior problem when we have large P, basically we just need to modify the priors. Okay. So Chen Chen in 2008 very recently he proposed an expanded BIC which assigns the prior in a very slightly different way. So just as I mentioned, you can model the space into the union of SJ, each SJ containing the models with the same number of predictors. Within this subset of SJ, you can assign equal prior, that's no problem. But across different SJ, like different model space with different dimensions, then we assign that probability. So using an ordinary BIC, we assign that probability SJ is proportional to that. But we want to actually downsize this. Okay? So we put a power Kc there. So Kc is a power is a constant between 0 and 1. If it equals 1, then that's the same as BIC. If it is 0, it totally downsizes this. Okay? So if under that consideration, using Laplace transformation again, then the BIC criteria reduced. You just have an extra penalty term. You see, everything becomes very simple. You just have an extra penalty term that taking consideration of the model space size. Okay. So gamma equals 1 minus C. When Kc equals 1, that is BIC, you see, this term vanishes. So BIC is simple. It's just a special case of eBIC. So the last term is the extra penalty we enforce into this criteria to penalize the dimension of the model. Now, Chen Chen 2008 proposed this for linear regression, and my collaborator and I approved consistency of eBIC for general likelihood estimation. Okay. So that is basically the criteria we can use, which can actually solve the problem of high dimensional space. So we use that, we apply this in a data set I mentioned at the beginning. So in chemogenomics field, scientists often conduct two aspects of the measurements. They obtain activity level measurements of certain drugs, and in the meantime, they obtain gene expression profile of the cell lines. So this type of data can be used to discover novel drug target and elucidate pathways. Okay. So we have large set of predictors greater than 20,000. Okay, so this is the model I've mentioned. Okay, so still 20,000. If we do regression, still that is not manageable. So we use a tournament approach proposed by Chen Chen. First, we partition the set of covariates into some manageable blocks, And for each block of subset, we used lasso regression. Lasso regression is just L1 penalty regression. And select a fixed number of significant covariates. And then we pull them together, and then each model, all the nested sequence of nesting model will be fully examined by the model selection technique. So here I gave out the lasso regression. So it simply minimized the mean square errors plus the L1 penalties. Okay. And it's worth to mention that in practice, people use lasso because it has very simple computational program available. They use least angle regression, which can realize as lasso regression in a very computational efficient way and provides the full sequence of nesting models when lambda increase from 0 to infinity. So it gives you all the possible models you could have when lambda from 0 to infinity. Okay, and when you have that, for each model, you just apply the EBIC and to compare it. So given the sequence of nested models, we can utilize the EBIC to determine the best model. So we use that. Okay. So we applied our method on this NCI 60 cell lines, and there are 47 cell lines with drug activity measurements. There are a total 22,283 genes being measured. Okay, so we want to get our model. So we select the top 2,000 genes, which differs mostly between two cell lines, because my collaborators and the biologists know that these two cell lines are very similar, but their drug response are quite different. So they think the genes which are actually manipulated by the drug should have the biggest difference in expression in terms of these two cell lines. Okay. So that's based on some biological information. We refine our predictor set. Now, based on these 2,000 predictors, we used the lasso regression to get the final 200 candidates, and then for these 200 candidates, we run the lasso and get a sequence of estimators, a sequence of predictors entering into the model. And then for each model, we measure the EBIC. So as you can see at step 15, with 9 predictors included, the EBIC attains the minimum value. So that is the model we think is the most reasonable one. So that is the plot of the EBIC curve at the 9, with nine predictors included, the EBIC criteria attains the minimum. And then for the others, okay, for the other part of the genes, that is the third layer of the network, we can also use the EBIC criteria to do the model selection to construct the Gaussian graphic model. So I omit the details, but it's very easy to implement. So here we, for the 200 predictors, we can construct a network with 1,575 edges. Here I just gave a subgraph of the third layer of the network, but we can construct the full picture without any problem. So very easily done. Okay. So that's how we, the exercise we've done on this data set. So the last is the conclusion. So throughout this talk, I mentioned that when we do model selection technique, the main thing we have to keep in mind is to ensure the consistency of our technique. And this consistency, both scenarios, both p-fixed or p goes to infinity, requires on the careful choice of the tuning parameters or the penalty function. And then based on the theoretical development, we propose a systematic approach of constructing network structures for chemogenomic data. And also for future work, so far we only look at static network. That means there's no temporal data. So, but in practice, scientists conducted temporal measurements of the gene expressions as well. That's more actually informative. So we want to look at other techniques which can build dynamic networks incorporating temporal information. And also, when I do the Gaussian graphic model, everything, interaction is linear. So it's very natural to think there could be nonlinear interaction between the vertices. So that means we want to do the nonlinear network modeling versus the linear modeling we have achieved here. But still, there's a problem selecting the edges, okay? So, I have a collaborator who is an applied mathematician. He said, I can do a nonlinear dynamic system, But I think still you have 20,000 genes. You have to determine which equations to use. Do you have a very good idea of write-out dynamic system, which are parsimonious and reflecting the true mechanism here? So that's something we wish to do in future. And also the consistency here, we only ensure the consistency of each local neighborhood. But for the overall graph, because of the number of vertices goes to infinity, for each fixed vertices, the consistency is guaranteed. But for the overall graph, because the number of vertices goes to infinity, this approach cannot ensure consistency of the overall graph. So that's a future problem we should tackle as well. Okay. So thank you.